I'm going to open this morning with a story I told at the service of remembrance we held down in the chapel a few weeks ago on the tragic 4th anniversary of the beginning of the Iraqi War. So I asked the forbearance of those who were there for the next few minutes. In thinking of what I consider to be some of the prouder moments of my life, I had to go back nearly, not quite, but almost 40 years for this one. And really it wasn't until some time had gone by after it that I recognized it and appreciated it as a proud moment. I think that's the case with some of these things. I was 22 years old. I was even younger than my son is now. The day was February the 6th, 1968. The place was Washington, D.C., more specifically the Arlington National Cemetery. I was a seminarian. I had traveled to Washington from Rochester, New York with a few of my classmates for a large gathering of at least a couple thousand religious leaders from across America, sponsored by an organization called Clergy and Laity, concerned about Vietnam. We were based at a very large downtown church, the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church. The highlight, and most publicly visible part of this gathering, was to have been a peace vigil held at Arlington National Cemetery, both to remember the war dead and to hear an address by Martin Luther King. At almost the 11th hour, a court order was secured that enjoined us from meeting there and enjoined Dr. King from speaking there on the grounds that we were a partisan group and not sufficiently patriotic enough to hold such an event on that site. A last-minute compromise was worked out, though, whereby we were permitted to hold a 10-minute silent vigil in the cemetery and would then go back to the church where we were meeting to hear Dr. King's address. And I still remember getting onto one of the buses, this caravan of buses that took us out to the cemetery, and being firmly instructed not to say a word from the moment we got off until we reboarded. In light of the questioning of our patriotism, we were each given a small American flag to carry with us, which I did. And I must have been on one of the first buses to leave the church, since I found myself near the front of the crowd as we gathered at the place where we were to be. I was close enough that if I kind of looked around and over and like this, the heads and the shoulders of the people who were standing in front of me, I was actually able to see Dr. King along with Rabbi Abraham Heschel and a Catholic bishop who were facing us. And I could just, there was no amplification there, I could just barely hear Dr. King say, "In this period of absolute silence, let us pray." After a time of silence had gone by, Rabbi Heschel spoke a phrase in Hebrew that translates, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" These words are originally found in one of the Psalms in the Hebrew scripture. They are reported to have been the last words spoken by Jesus before he died on the cross. And then the Catholic bishop, whose identity I did not get, simply said, "Let us go in peace. Amen." And we silently returned to our buses and went back to the church, where we heard Martin Luther King offer a stinging critique of the war, of what it was doing to our soldiers, what it was doing to the Vietnamese people, and how it was tearing at the fabric of what was a very polarized nation at that time. Slightly less than 2 months later, Dr. King was murdered in Memphis at the age of 39. And the scriptural words spoken by Rabbi Heschel, "My God, why hast thou forsaken me or forsaken us," came to have an eerie ring and an eerie echo to both the black and white Americans who had come to recognize and value the prophetic stance that Dr. King had truly attained. It wasn't that we felt forsaken by God so much, but just by the blow of the assassination itself. That time has much been on my mind recently. I think now about how the third Monday of each January now, we celebrate a national holiday in honor of a man who only 2 months before his death was not considered sufficiently patriotic enough to deliver a speech in a national cemetery because he was opposed to a war we were waging. I think of how that clergy and laity organization I was a part of was accused of undermining the morale of the troops because we wanted them to come home. I remember being told that if we didn't stop the communists in Hanoi, we'd be having to fight them right here in America. Today, we enjoy full diplomatic relationships with the unified Vietnam, with Hanoi as its capital, and Dr. King is accorded a national holiday. I think of these things now as I hear yet another stanza of a distressingly familiar song. But I won't belabor that point, however. I don't feel I need to in this setting, given some of the things I've said previously over the past 4 to 5 years. I don't know that my song needs to start sounding overly familiar as well. But what I mostly recall from this instance, really why I tell this story, is, and I want to hold up for a minute, because what I really remember is how proud I felt with all of my 22 years of living to be standing in the presence of Dr. King. And that sense carries through to this day. I am proud to have stood with a man who was much vilified in his day for the moral stances he took, but who turned out to be on the right side of history. And as his legacy has grown and become more fully understood and appreciated, as well as debated in this country as it should be, my pride at having been a witness to only a small, single snapshot of Dr. King's amazing ministry has only increased. And I have to say the ministry in which I have now been engaged for nearly the 40 years since that day has been at least partially defined by that moment. Defined by a moment when I saw how persons and how religious leaders from a variety of faith backgrounds can stand together in moral witness when the occasion and circumstances call for it. And even though it was a painful time, I'm very glad that I was there. I want to expand out from this experience a little bit, offer the same thoughts to the rest of you, because I think it's the moments when we feel pride, whether it's pride of accomplishment, whether it's pride of achievement, you know, like seeing a son or daughter graduate college, as Michelle and I will in a few weeks from now, or as in the instance I've just described of being part of a profound and moving moment. For it is these kinds of proud moments that really tell us a good deal about who we are, what we value the most. They're the moments that tell us about how we choose and have chosen to live our lives. And I would invite each of you to do a little personal inventory sometime, hopefully sometime after I'm done talking so you can kind of stay focused here. But I would invite you to do a little personal inventory about what you really do consider to be your prouder moments. And then reflect out from that and think about how those moments have both defined and affected the course of your life. Well, given all I've said to this point, how then did something like pride come to head up a list of something called the 7 deadly sins? The psychiatrist, social ethicist, and author Dr. Willard Galen in his book Feelings asks the same question. He has a line there where he says, how in the world did a nice emotion like pride get elected the first of the 7 deadly sins? Why is not pride one of the cardinal virtues? Well, it's well put and it's well asked. And kind of a backup question, I'm going to take a little side loop for a minute to deal with that. A backup question could be, well, what are the 7 deadly sins and how do we get them? I think somebody asked me that in coffee hour a couple of weeks ago. So we're going to take, like I said, a quick side note to pick up on that, and then we'll sort of come back on the main pride road here in just a moment. The seven deadly sins. I think I can do them all in one breath here. They are pride, avarice, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, and sloth. See, they just kind of roll off the tongue, you know? Kind of the same way the comedian George Carlin can just roll off his tongue those seven words you can't say on TV. I could do those in one breath, too, but I'm going to leave that be. Even in a liberal church, we have some bounds of propriety, and I'd like to hold on to my job for a little bit longer. Well, no, the seven deadly sins, to get back to that, were originally formulated by Pope Gregory I, later known as Gregory the Great, during his papacy, clear back in the 6th century. A few centuries later, in the 13th century, they were revisited and reformulated by Thomas Aquinas. They're not biblical in any precise way, in that there's no verse in the Bible that begins, "These are the seven deadly sins," and then lists them off. Instead, they were an attempt by the Catholic Church to come up with a set of categories under which or into every conceivable and committable sin could be classified or traced back to. Now, I'm not altogether sure what purpose that served, but I still can't help but be impressed at how Pope Gregory's and Thomas Aquinas' formulation have remained in place and remain in the popular consciousness over the centuries. He said Pope Gregory started this in the 6th century, we're still talking about the seven deadly sins. For example, back in 1993, the New York Times ran a 7-week series in their Sunday book review section, wherein they invited 7 prominent authors, 1 per week, each to contribute an article on one of the 7 deadly sins, writing from his or her literary perspective. It was a pretty fascinating piece. And so, like, here we are, 1,500 years later, give or take a century or two after they were devised, a secular publication like the New York Times does a series on the 7 deadly sins. So I figured with that kind of staying power, they had to have something going for them, and perhaps they serve some usefulness in helping us keep track of our human failings and misdeeds. Well, on that note, come back on the main road here to what Pope Gregory considered the headline sin, namely the sin of pride. And also revisit Dr. Gala's question about how he asked what a nice emotion like pride is doing at the head of that list. Well, the church made its case for the primacy of sin by noting that it was the first sin committed by the first human beings, Adam and Eve, in the Garden of Eden. You probably know the story. They eat the so-called forbidden fruit. There's no reference to an apple in the book of Genesis, by the way. They eat the so-called forbidden fruit, thereby gain knowledge of good and evil, and are subsequently banished from paradise. Now, even back when the Bible was the central and authoritative basis of my religious belief, I still couldn't figure that one out. I would ask, you know, what does the attainment of the knowledge of good and evil, which we all need to have, we're going to get through life in any decent way, what does the attainment of the knowledge of good and evil have to do with the sin of pride? And the answer I got was that the real sin of pride that Adam and Eve committed was in thinking that they knew more than God or that they were better than God. Well, that worked for a while. And in one sense, it still does, as I'll explain in a few minutes. And then as I began to look around at some other kinds of traditions and mythologies, I came to notice, once I became an English major, that there's a similar kind of a theme in Greek mythology as well, about pride. In fact, if I were to offer an extreme, Cliff Notes version of a Greek tragedy, it would go like this. Number 1, hero rises to great heights after seeking the help and guidance of the gods and goddesses. Part 2, hero reaches the point where he figures he's so great and so cool that he no longer needs to acknowledge his indebtedness to said gods and goddesses. Part 3, hero takes a great fall. A tragedy in 3 acts. I mean, that's the way they go. So several centuries, even before Pope Gregory I, the Greeks had their categories of sins and human transgressions as well. They had 4 of them instead of 7. And heading their list also was hubris, or pride. And the Greeks and the Romans had their mythology to back that up, just as the Judaic and Christian traditions came to have their mythologies to make the same point. So what is it? with the alleged sin of pride. I think the point being made, which you can probably pick up on easily enough, is that the shadow side of pride is a lack of humility, or the absence of a willingness to seriously examine one's motives and rationales in taking a certain course of action. The shadow side of pride is reaching a point where you figure you know best, regardless of any other input or opinion or challenge. To put it metaphorically, the shadow side of pride is thinking you know more than God, or even worse, thinking you have an exclusive pipeline directly into the mind and will of God. To put it in more human and humanistic language, the real sin of pride is in believing that your own thoughts, deeds, actions, and motivations are beyond any serious challenge or question. And I'd like to briefly return to the life of Martin Luther King to expand on this point. Dr. King was a very proud man who had a very clear sense of who he was and what he was about and where he wanted to go. He was also aware of and he struggled with his shortcomings and his personal failings. But he had many reasons to be proud. He came out of the segregated South of the late 1940s and early 1950s to earn a PhD at Boston University. He passed up what could have been a promising career in academia and answered a call to the African American church ministry instead. At the age of 30, following the Montgomery bus boycott, he was recognized as a premier civil rights leader in America, 30 years old. He stood next to Lyndon Johnson when the president signed the 64 civil rights bill, which he, Dr. King, had been instrumental in getting passed. And he was still 1 month shy of his 36th birthday when he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize. Who wouldn't be rightfully and fully proud of that? I'm sure Dr. King was, as he's had every reason to be. But as I read his biographies and I've listened to interviews with people who knew him best and worked most closely with him, the thing that has impressed me the most about all that is how he would so often turn to those whom he knew and trusted and who knew he did not and who knew didn't always share his same opinions about what particular course of action they should be taking. He would get them together to get their critique. I recall a televised interview with Andrew Young where he specifically spoke to this. Mr. Young recalled how Dr. King would gather a circle of advisors around him before taking a course of action and really ask them to just have at him as to how good of an idea or not they thought his plans were. He would deliberately seek out a wide range of opinion. He knew a lot of focus and a lot of attention was on him. And he was proud of that, but he also had enough humility to do checks to see if he was making the right move. He would deliberately seek out a wide range of opinion, and after the same course of action that had taken, he would do the same thing, ask some of those same people, was this the right thing to have done, or did we do it wrong? How could we have done it differently and better? Should we try this again? Should we let it go? And in the end, it was Dr. King who had to make the call and who had to live with the outcomes of his decisions. But he never became so full of himself that he avoided seeking an honest critique of himself and what he was doing. Dr. King was no biblical literalist, but he read his Bible in such a way that he took seriously the warnings he found in it about being so taken with your own greatness and your own knowledge and your own sureness that you cease questioning yourself. I just have to add, we now have a president who claims to seek similar divine guidance. I do not question his claim. I only wish he could find the same message in that divine guidance as Dr. King did. Well, I'm going to close on this note. We each and all need our proud moments. We need to have those positive, uplifting moments wherein we gain a better and more heightened sense of who we are and what we're about, what it is we most pride and value. We need to know the pride of accomplishment. We need to know the pride of achievement. For it is in such moments that we learn about our personal potentialities and possibilities that we may not have even known we had. Without such proud moments, in fact, our lives would have very little meaning or purpose or direction. Think for a moment about what a miserable life it would be if you went all the way through it without ever being proud of anything you ever did or were a part of. So I say cherish your proud moments. And I say cherish also the humility that comes with a true sense of pride. I think the Shakers, for all their strange and quaint ways, had it right in finding the true balance between pride and humility. They took pride in their simple tasks, in their creativity, in their achievements. They took pride in the way of life they created for themselves. And they complemented their simple but deeply held pride with an honoring of simplicity and of knowing where one should rightfully come down, as they put it. So when I reflect on my own proud moments, I often find myself recalling them at the same time. That Shaker hymn that I want us to close our service with today, it's number 16, "It's a Gift to Be Simple." We'll sing it through twice.